Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is novelist and San Francisco Chronicle columnist Vanessa Hua, who's used her reporting as the basis for two wonderful novels. In her debut novel, she told a contemporary story of Chinese immigration, motherhood, and the very real effects of human trafficking. In her latest novel, she turns to modern Chinese history and the beginnings of China's Cultural Revolution, a time of mass hysteria and generational conflict that was urged on by the chairman of the Communist Party, Mao Zedong, to reclaim day-to-day control of the country. This period of political repression and the use of students as enforcers led to the death to as many as a million people and the exile, denunciation, and blacklisting of millions of others. In her book, Forbidden City, Hua was inspired by documentary footage of Mao cavorting and dancing with a cadre of teenage girls. These young women actually served in Mao's court, if you will, as entertainment, sometimes intimate partners, and sometimes political confidants of the chairman. In the book, Mei Xiang, a daughter of peasants, is plucked away from her village, given acting and dancing lessons, then brought to Mao, where he's taken with her. She gains his confidence and becomes a participant in the social upheaval that is on the cusp of occurring. As she learns Mao's true nature, she becomes disillusioned and eventually flees. Vanessa Hua is a veteran reporter, now a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. She's a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellow and received the Asia Pacific American Award for Literature. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Vanessa Hua, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Rich.
As you write in your author's note at the end of Forbidden City, this novel was inspired by some documentary footage of Chairman Mao mingling and dancing with a group of young girls. First, what did you want to know about that footage, and how did it inspire you to write the novel, Forbidden City?
Well, about a decade and a half ago, I was watching this documentary about China, and up pops this footage of Mao surrounded by giggling teenage girls. Some of them were in plaid. They almost reminded me of Bobby Soxers. And it turned out that he was a fan of ballroom dancing. And in fact, there was an American journalist, Agnes Smedley, who traveled to Yan'an, a rebel stronghold, in 1937, and taught Mao and other top leaders how to do the foxtrot, square dancing. It was a place of few amusements. And in the decades that followed, he had these cultural work troops of young women who would not only partner with him on the dance floor, but some of them would become his companions. They would handle his correspondence. They'd translate his speech when it became garbled. People would have to go through them in order to get to him. And I just found that incredible that these young women were raised to believe him a god, and then they're a part of his inner circle. And I was wondering what that must have been like and how they survived those years. I mean, one woman that I'm thinking of, Zhang Yufeng, met him when he was 18 and then was at his side when he passed away and she was 31. And how did she survive all those years in the country's very center of power? The other thing that motivated me was when I was looking for research about them, there wasn't much. The chairman's physician wrote a memoir and he sort of references these young women and says, oh, it was the most exciting, most exhilarating experience of their lives. And the tone was almost dismissive. And I knew the story had to be more complicated than that. And I feel that fiction can really flourish where the official record ends. And that's the space in which I entered Forbidden City.
Let's talk about that idea of surviving near the seat of power during this period of Chinese history was a feat in and of itself. You had leaders that would come into favor, out of favor, and being out of favor meant, at the very least, losing their position, losing face, being exiled, or worse. So why was this cadre of young women trusted so much?
I think because they were not his handpicked successors. If you were Mao's handpicked successor, that was almost like a curse, right? Because sooner or later, he's going to feel that he could no longer trust you, that you you know, that they were in fact rivals and wanted to be in power now. And so he was quite isolated from the other top leaders, I learned, even though many of them were living in Zhongnanhai, which is what I call it the lake palaces in the novel. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they just correspond through letters, through reports. And he was quite isolated. And it was the company he kept was mostly at the side of bodyguards or nurses or confidential clerks, like whatever. So it was these young people that he felt he could trust because they weren't trying to rise the ranks, to lead the country.
One of the interesting parts of your novel is it reminds us how an absolute dictator sees the world through the eyes of those currying favor around him. And it kind of reminds me of what we're seeing in Russia today with Vladimir Putin. I mean, he's getting this story very much colored by what he desires to hear from those who absolutely depend on him for their status and position.
Exactly. I think we could see parallels throughout time, throughout different countries. And that's something that I found with historical fiction, that not only does it provide a window on a time and place different than our own, it also helps us reflect on our own present. And I saw so many threads that, for example, the language of it wouldn't have appeared in the book because it would have been anachronistic, but the Me Too movement, the rise of demagoguery, the debilitating loneliness that the pandemic caused, the sense of isolation and distance from our families, or the social breakdown, all of that in this, 14 years I took to write the book influenced how I shaped the book, even though, of course, I live in 2020 and the book is set in 1960s China.
Yeah. That sense of isolation comes throughout the book as your main character, Mei Xiang, is basically plucked from a peasant village and brought to Beijing and basically denied any further contact with her family for the most part. And I guess that was the fate of all these young women that came to Beijing?
Well, the thought was, well, who do you prize more, your family or the revolution? And not only, say, in the dance troupe, we would, in those years, there'd be instances of, the parents were busy doing quote-unquote important work, and so the children, they lived apart from their very young children. And so I think we can't forget there was a sense of idealism, that this wasn't just like brainwashing, that there was hope for the country. And this is why people were willing to make that sacrifice and to be parted from their families. But of course, as we saw, a lot of that idealism, especially in the case of May, ended up in disillusionment, that it was a very hard time. Exactly for that reason, because everything they dreamed of a better world, but then reality proved far different.
Now, when we meet Mei Xing, she is in the United States. It's the occasion of Mao's death, and she's telling her story to someone. And this story was erased to history in the novel. And also, this story was erased for the real-life women that were plucked from their homes and sent to Beijing. What was available to learn about this episode in Mao's life?
Well, there were references to it, as I mentioned, in the doctor's memoir. And it's interesting. Later on, after I'd written many drafts of the book, like say even just in the last 2 or 3 years, there have been interviews or references with some of these women who survived those years. And yet nothing still really got at the rhythms of the daily life behind closed doors. So some of the later research I found substantiated the dynamics within the dance troupe that I had imagined, that I'd used empathy to try and picture in the life of a teenage girl or a young woman. But others just are not going to be, the details that I, as a fiction writer, I'm interested in are not going to be listed in any official record, because that's not who gets included in history, right? That's not, there might be a very, there are exhaustive accounts of the rivalries among public officials, let's say, and their faiths, but not so much about these women at his side.
And I would assume the rivalries were just as bitter within that dance troupe as well, because they're all currying favor. It's about,
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's the story of it.
Oh, well, I did want to add, so on one hand, that you might think, oh, teenagers, the rivalries, but it really did mirror what was to come in the Cultural Revolution, that it started, in fact, among middle schoolers, if you can believe it, and high schoolers, and then college students, all idealistic and acting in the name of the revolution and protecting Mao. But in the end, it resulted in revenge and petty scores getting settled between neighbors, between students on their teachers, or even children against their parents. So even though teenage girls or their concerns are sometimes dismissed or seem as relevant, in some ways they're bellwethers for how a country will go, not only in China, but elsewhere.
This book had me going back to learning about the Chinese history of this period. Mao's power at the time you're writing about was considered somewhat on the wane. He had been the author of The Great Leap Forward, which had been this disastrous effort to collectivize the farmland of China, to take people from the city to work the land, and really some incredibly dubious theories, which would be like overplant fields because the seeds will not compete with each other. You know, just some crazy ideas. And it resulted in a huge famine that lost in the millions of lives. And so he's on the cusp of the Cultural Revolution. This is really a place where Mao reestablishes his authority through the young people.
Yes, yes, who were born after the revolution. As I said, they're middle schoolers. So May, my character, is as old as the PRC itself, born in 1949. The novel opens, she's on the eve of her 16th birthday. And it was interesting when I did research, when I first began, all that I really knew of the Cultural Revolution were the images, the young people in the old army uniforms waving their little red books. I think that's what a lot of Americans know of it. And understanding that this was Mao responding because he worried about his legacy. He saw what was happening in the Soviet Union, how Khrushchev was rewriting Stalin, or rather the truth of what Stalin did was coming to light. And he didn't want that. He wanted to regain power, and the way to topple his enemies, and like the rebel leader he was to not attack them directly, but to turn to the masses who adored him. But of course he couldn't really control them either. And you know, the country, it was extreme chaos for 10 years with the country spinning out of control.
Yeah, people would be denunciated, put out of power. Then within a few years, they would come back to power. It was that sort of chaotic situation. And of course, you talk about the young people leading the revolution. It was a lot of score settling. It was denunciations of the intelligentsia. Intellectuals, and it was a time of great death too. It was beyond just, you know, people losing their jobs. I mean, many times they were killed, and this
or they killed themselves. It was horrific. I mean, and there's a whole genre of literature called scar literature of those who were impacted by the horror of those years. And in fact, I was actually just talking to someone I know whose parents grew up in the Cultural Revolution. And I asked, is this something that they, you know, is it taught in schools? And she's like, of course not, it's forbidden. And some of that generation are hesitant to tell their kids because they're worried their kids will bring it up at school and that will cause consequences. So it's really a matter of, even though there was this immense turmoil, there hasn't been a full reckoning. And for May, it's the occasion of the chairman's death where she faces some long suppressed memories That, you know, so often refugees or immigrants have a lot of trauma that they, you know, they feel like, let's just focus on the future. I just need to do what I can to survive. And it's difficult to have a reckoning, especially if it's neighbor against neighbor, especially if any true criticism would criticize Mao, because to criticize Mao would be to criticize the very foundation of the country.
My guest today is Vanessa Hua. She's a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and a novelist. Her latest novel is set at the beginning of China's Cultural Revolution, titled Forbidden City. It tells the story of Mei Xiang, a young girl that sort of enters Chairman Mao's orbit, along with a lot of other young women that were dancing partners, sometimes sexual partners, that was a part of Mao's life during the 1960s. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, one of the things really interesting I thought about this book was Mei's character suggests swimming the Yangtze River, which was considered a very symbolic gesture by Mao. What was so important about that? This whole, I guess it was to show that he was vital. He was ready to take back control of the country from really political leadership that hadn't marginalized him, but he was periphery to the everyday workings of the country at that particular point. What was important about that?
Yes, exactly. And that was fascinating for me to discover. And actually, one way for me to access his character, this hugely iconic individual whose face is on the cover of millions of copies of Little Red Book and is hanging on this gigantic portrait in Tiananmen Square even today. And, you know, he learned how to swim as a peasant boy. And even in his youth, they would, you know, he and his other classmates would march around the countryside, like bare-chested against the elements or swimming to show their physical endurance. And so the time of what's portrayed in the novel is this famed swim in July that he appeared on the coverall, the newspaper, clad in this shining white robe. And it was like a way of saying, I'm back. I'm virile. I'm strong. I am ready to take charge of this country again. And it actually kicked off this swimming craze. It had been going on for just people all over in the cities and the countryside were learning how to swim because it was this thought of like you strong bodies, you know, strong country. And Mei, as I said, because I was exploring the subtle ways that his companions could have influenced world events who suggests this to him. And, you know, that's one of the things she has to reckon with, that what if she hadn't, what if she'd suggested going somewhere else instead of taking on this turbulent swim? Would the Cultural Revolution have unfolded in the same way? And I think that's something that people who are footnotes to history or not even a footnote, what is the influence they carry? And that was something I wanted to explore in Forbidden City.
Yeah. And Mei is also an important plot point where Mao is working against his president. He fears that the president has Western tendencies, that he is not totally committed to the revolution. And in your novel, you use the character of Mei of sort of putting a little worm in the president's ear about, you know, setting the students against the university as a way of gaining control. It's really interesting because, when you hear about how dictatorships run, you know, the dictator doesn't put his dirty hands in the business. He uses intermediaries. And it's very subtle how you portray that in Forbidden City.
Yes, it was. Thank you for highlighting that. And definitely it was really interesting to explore the psychology of powerful men and how suggesting it, you know, there's almost a reverse psychology going on where she suggests something and the president wants to dismiss it. But then the moment the chairman says, interesting idea, the president then claims it for his own. So I mean, the chairman and May both are resourceful. They're wily, and you know, people in various ways over their lifetimes have sort of dismissed them or counted them out. And I think that's who you watch out for, right? That the people that you don't necessarily suspect as having agency, or you know, thoughts that you know, the thoughts and desires of their own.
It's interesting you brought that up, not having agency, because, you know, May comes from a family where she is third daughter, and she's berated by the first daughter, somewhat consoled by the mediator, second daughter. But she comes from a place where she's sort of marginalized and put aside, and she sort of shares that with Chairman Mao, how Mao is feeling at this particular time, where he is not the center, complete center of attention from the political leadership.
Yes, exactly. And people have asked, like, how did you develop this relationship between a young woman and a much older man? But when people are alone, there are ways that they are going to connect with each other, not only physically, but just what are the ways in which there might be commonality. That's certainly when they're swimming at the pool or on the dance floor, where there's frequent dances that she's a part of, and she has to do what she can to maintain her position at his side.
My guest today is Vanessa Hua, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and novelist. Her latest book, set in the beginnings of China's Cultural Revolution, is titled Forbidden City. It's published by Ballantine Books, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I was reading some interviews with you, and you said one of the things you were trying to do in this very long journey, you said you've been working on it 14 years, was that you tried to interview people who lived through the Cultural Revolution. And it sounds like that was a pretty difficult thing to do, even though we would think, you know, 50 years in the past, that's way back in the rearview mirror. People are still reticent to talk about that.
Yes, I think it's painful, or they're worried what may happen to them. If someone official gets wind of them talking about it, or I share in the author's note, going to a store that was selling these Cultural Revolution tchotchkes, and there was a man, it was a statuette of a man kneeling with a placard around his neck that said "Down with capitalists," and there's a man with his foot on his back and waving a sword. And the shopkeeper hurriedly said, like, "Oh, he didn't get hurt. That was just for show." And of course not. Yes, there were deaths and terrible things happened during the Cultural Revolution, but he felt a need to sort of, I don't know, smooth it over. Or I remember I was interviewing some grannies in a village, and one woman, she talked about how she was able to take night classes and learned how to read and write while with a baby strapped on her back. And in the generations that followed, you know, her son had a good job. And I just thought about how that benefit pays off. I thought that was so interesting because, you know, she was confident. And then, but compared to this other granny, when I asked about those years, she instantly shut down and said, "Oh, I don't know how to read. I'm stupid. Don't ask me about this." So there is, I think, something going on with, like, should I trust this outsider? But then also within the village, it's very hard to grapple with the horrors of those years.
And you're living, you know, when you're interviewing people of that age, they would have been the young people of that era who might have been very much caught up in it and caught up in what appears to look to me like a typical mass hysteria. You know, like when we had Red Scares in the United States and other places where we marginalize people we consider to be the other, this was a similar occasion in China.
Definitely. I think that's... And there is that reckoning in May that on one hand, she was swept up in those times. But on the other hand, to say you're swept up, there's still an individual responsibility. And that can be very difficult to face, even if you are very young and at the time. And, you know, questions of what does it mean in the cult? What does it mean of the culture that shaped you? What does it, how do you go forward? How do you find a way through? And it was interesting. I read an article about how in among Gen Z in China, there is some appeal in Mao because they see the vast inequity in socioeconomic standards. And because they were born 2 decades after he died. And so they're fascinated by someone they see as strong. And if you don't learn the history of what happened under him, then of course you would revere him. Mm.
It's interesting. Without giving too much away, May eventually becomes disillusioned with Chairman Mao. And can you sort of give us a sense of where that disillusionment comes from? Is it just the callous nature of how he responds to, you know, people being hurt, people being killed? What's at the heart of that disillusionment?
Well, I think to begin with, maybe to understand how she, you know, where she began, I think it's she was entirely formed by these stories of model revolutionaries, that there seemed no greater ambition or desire than to be someone who sacrificed everything for their people. So that's the mindset she has when she arrives in the capital, that she's finally got a chance to do the ultimate duty, whatever it is. She doesn't know quite yet until she gets there. And then she meets the chairman. And she, at first, when his crassness, his cruelty, she tries to dismiss it. Like, it must be something wrong with her, she thinks, or she tries to not think about it. But as time goes on and she spends a year intensely with him, she gains a broader understanding. Of course, there's things she just won't understand because people aren't telling her, but she's resourceful. She begins to piece things together but ultimately she breaks with him as she sees the horrors of the Cultural Revolution unfolding and understanding that it was never about the revolution for Mao, and that the chairman is doing whatever he can to hold on to power, even if that means sacrificing herself or other young people.
Well, it's a really interesting book. Forbidden City is the name of it. The story of Mei Sheng recounts this story on the occasion of Mao's death and tells of her small novelistic role in the Cultural Revolution. Vanessa Hua, thanks very much for joining us again.
Pleasure talking to you, Rich.
Novelist Vanessa Hua is also a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Her latest book, set in the beginnings of China's Cultural Revolution, is titled Forbidden City. It's published by Ballantine Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.